Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
I think the most important question is, what should I do to live a more fulfilling life? And in the last chapter, I deal with happiness research, how to lead a purposeful, meaningful life. And we know something about this now. There's been quite a bit of research in the last quarter century in what's called positive psychology. And, you know, having a purposeful work, a meaningful, purposeful work, a reason to get up in the morning, get out, do something productive, having family and friends and loved ones, people that care about you, people that you care about, you know, this leads to a more fulfilling life. Having some kind of spirituality, it doesn't have to be religion, but it can be, but, you know, it could be meditation, it could be dance, it could be art, music, literature, long walks on the beach, long hikes, you know, anything that kind of gets you out of your little space into the bigger world in a way that's contemplative. And then also non-egocentric activities, you know, volunteering, helping the poor, volunteering for nonprofits, you know, things like that, just doing stuff that's not just about you. Those are the kinds of things, you know, long-term planning. That is, say, you know, balance your daily life of just fun, pleasurable things with things that are not necessarily pleasurable, but bring meaning. That is, they're more long-term, like caretaking for a parent or a loved one. You know, that's not fun. I've done it twice for two of my four parents. I had step-parents. You know, it wasn't fun, wasn't pleasurable. It was, you know, tiring and uncomfortable and, you know, so on. But I felt better about it myself for doing it. And, you know, those are the sorts of things we know. That, again, regardless of whether there's an afterlife or not, no one knows for sure. Probably not. But if there is, okay, we can all be pleasantly surprised. But it doesn't matter, you know, because we don't live in the afterlife. We live in this life.
To be mortal is a most basic human experience, and yet man has never been able to accept it, grasp it, and behaves accordingly. Man doesn't know how to be mortal. The haunting words of Czech-born French writer Milan Kundera from his 1990 book, Immortality. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Why do most of us believe that death is not final? And what has the world of science got to say about beyond death? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack those questions with American writer, journalist, and the publisher of Skeptic.com, Dr. Michael Shermer, whose latest book, Heavens on Earth, has just been published by Little Brown, where Michael argues, longings make us all subject to a number of cognitive biases, most notably the confirmation bias, in which we look for and find confirming evidence and ignore disconfirming evidence. Michael goes on to write, once you get to the Christian heaven, what's it like? Since no one has ever gone and come back with irrefutable evidence, believers must once again be content with biblical archaeological narratives sprung entirely from the imagination of the narrators. So what is heaven? Where is it? And how do we find meaning if there is no afterlife?
Hi, it's Michael Shermer here. I'm from Southern California. I'm the publisher of Skeptic Magazine. I'm a monthly columnist for Scientific American, and I'm a presidential fellow at Chapman University, where I teach critical thinking and honors courses, and when I'm not doing my day job, I write books. So my latest book is Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. And my previous book was The Moral Arc, about moral progress over the centuries, and probably my most famous book is Why People Believe Weird Things, and there's a lot of weird things out there. So that's it.
What an enjoyable read, Michael. I have to say, Heavens on Earth. You present so many interesting moral questions to the reader, as well as so many unusual social and cultural scenarios. And it is extraordinary to see the different questions the different people that you met are asking of the world and of themselves. And, you know, the different types of belief systems within the world and how, I suppose, we all rationalise different events in our lives in our own particular way. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off. When I say the word heavenly, what comes into mind?
Well, I think as an adjective, people think of something kind of warm and glowy and nice and paradisiacal in the kind of theological sense. And that is, in a way, what most religions picture heaven as, is this place that we can be that's better than where we're at now. So, and the reason I included utopia in the subtitle of my book and have two chapters on that is that people try to create a heavenly version of life here on Earth, just in case there's no heavenly afterlife. And so all those are lumped in that idea that there is this place that we can get to somehow, and we're not there now, and maybe in some versions it used to be that way. There's, you know, the Garden of Eden, the, you know, the Renaissance of the rebirth of this golden age of Greece, and the ancient Greeks had an idea that there was a golden age before them. There is this longing for some kind of paradisiacal place we can get to, and the fact is we know enough now to know that there is no such place, either in the past or the future. There's no utopia, there's no heaven, there's no perfect place. It's the striving to enhance our lives is what life is all about, but nevertheless, that's there in our brains, and it drives a lot of human civilization, this kind of striving for something out there.
Michael, do you think the concept of mortality is incomprehensible for most people? And within all of that, do you think when anybody goes about contemplating their death or death itself, that it changes how you view your life entirely?
Yes, it does. The problem is that you can't conceive of not being alive. I mean, if I say imagine being dead, you can't do it, because to imagine anything, you have to be alive. I mean, the closest we could get would be something like general anesthesia. You know, it's just they inject you and it's, you know, boom, boom, lights out. It's just you're gone, and then you wake up. But there's no sense of lapsed time. People under general anesthesia have no idea how long they've been out, because there's no conscious activity of time passing. So death would be something like that. It's hard to grasp it. We use words like, you know, you're going no place, or I say in the beginning of the book, you know, when people ask me, where do you think you go? Where are you after you're dead? In the same place you were before you were born. To which most people say, what? I wasn't anywhere before I was born. Right. You didn't exist before you were born. You won't exist after you're dead. You know, we just have this window of time. But it doesn't feel like that. You know, intuitively, we feel like we're dualistic beings. That is, we have a brain and a mind. You know, we don't sense our brain operating, so it feels like there's thoughts floating around up there. And in the same way, we feel like we have a soul, something that is not material, that continues on somehow. And that is the basis for these afterlife beliefs. I can't imagine being dead, so there has to be some place. Now let's imagine what that place is like.
I imagine writing a book like this that has, you know, when you're contemplating death and, you know, and all the kind of ideas around it and the places that we go to or whatever, that it reminds you of what's important in the life that you're living now.
Mm-hmm. It puts things into perspective, I think, in a positive way. I'm an atheist and my book is a science book. And I don't think there's an afterlife, although I can't prove it. No one can prove whether there is or is not an afterlife. But to me, if anything, thinking that there may not be an afterlife, that puts a punctuation mark on this life. And in any case, as I say at the end of the book, whether there's an afterlife or not, it doesn't matter, because we don't live in the afterlife. We live in this life. Whether there's a hereafter doesn't matter, because we live here now. So I think in that sense, contemplating the idea of death, the afterlife, and immortality, and so on, can help focus your attention on what really matters, which is here, now, this life, the people you love and that you interact with, and your society, and being engaged with your community, and you know, doing things every day that not just improve yourself, but improve the lives of those around you and your community as a whole. Those are the sorts of things that matter. More than the, you know, the day-to-day mundane stuff. And, you know, we know, I cite a lot of research in the book about, you know, what it takes to lead a happy, fulfilling, meaningful, purposeful life. And it's not just having fun. You know, much of it, people report the deepest, most important things they ever do in their lives are not fun. They're not pleasurable. They're not pleasure-seeking activities. They're things that have to do with long-term goals and striving and struggling and conflict and things to overcome. So, you know, when people describe heaven as this heavenly perfect place where, you know, there's nothing to do, to me that sounds boring. You know, I want challenges in heaven, whatever it is. I want something to do. That's what our nature is.
You mention a very impactful teacher that you had at university. I think his name was Professor Richard Hardison. And he clearly, from reading the book, presented some unbelievable lectures to you. But he asked you at one stage, and all the students, are there tennis courts and golf courses? And I screamed out laughing. But you do present this Gallup poll, which is a particularly illuminating one, which found that between 72% and 83% of Americans believe in heaven, and a third of agnostics and atheists proclaim belief in the afterlife. I thought that was astounding, because I can't figure out how atheists can square that one up.
Yes, I know. I was astounded by that too, because I'm an atheist and I don't believe in heaven. So what is it that these people believe? Okay, now the poll didn't ask, but you know, I know this community well enough to know, I suspect that the idea of the continuation of consciousness after the death of the body is what they're going for there. And there are versions of this in different non-Western religions, Buddhism, Taoism, Hinduism, you know, they all have different versions of this that, you know, this is the idea of reincarnation, that your body is gone, but your soul continues on. Now, what is the soul? Well, really, it's just your pattern of information that represents you. I mean, even while you're alive, we know, for example, that almost all of the cells in your body are recycled about every 7 to 10 years. So you're not the same Susan you were a decade ago. You have all new material, and yet you still feel like you. You know, the unit that calls itself Susan and your memories and so on. So it's the pattern of information. So in philosophy, this is called the problem of identity, who you are. There's a famous thought experiment called Theseus's ship. The ancient Greek Theseus was a hero for slaying this evil dragon, and his returns in his ship, and they preserve the ship in a museum. But the wood starts to rot, and they replace the wood, and eventually none of the original wood of Theseus' ship exists anymore, yet still people rever the ship, because it's not the wood that matters, it's the idea, the information behind it. And that's the idea of a soul, is that it's your pattern of information. And so this is why the scientists, people that want to achieve immortality, or like Woody Allen, they don't want to live on in their work, they want to live on in their apartment. You know, they're trying to figure out a way to keep the pattern alive. And, you know, currently the pattern is stored in the electric meat of our brains, the, you know, wet, warm environment that's pretty fragile and doesn't last, you know, but 40 years. So there has to be some way to upload that into a computer, into the cloud, somehow keep it going, have it cryonically frozen and brought back 1,000 years from now, whatever. There's all these scientific attempts to achieve immortality that I write about in the book. They're fascinating because it does propel us to think about what it means to be alive, what the soul is, who are you really? Because you're not a fixed set of patterns. The patterns change. Your memories change. Your beliefs change. Your thoughts change. So what is the idea of a fixed you? And you know, then we're off and running. These are the deepest, you know, questions that humans have ever asked. And so, you know, writing this book, researching and writing this book was, you know, really got me, you know, there were some dark, you know, candlelit nights going, wow, you know, what is this all about?
You mentioned Christopher Hitchens in the book, and I think you were quite friendly with him, but he was very interrogative of death and of life right up to the end, wasn't he? He was unbelievably courageous.
Yes, Hitch was a friend, and I knew him for a long time, and you know, he's a bigger-than-life character, and when he got cancer, he did what he does best, is write about it. I mean, he's an elegant, beautiful writer. He wrote a number of columns in Vanity Fair, where he was a columnist, about his cancer, you know, the topic of cancer, and this is the most famous one, but there were others, Tumor Town, you know, and what it's like to go through chemotherapy, that sort of stuff. These are all gathered in a book. I think it's called Mortality, Christopher Hitchens. And you know, he famously said, as I quote in the book, that, you know, if there's a heaven, the Christian heaven would be like celestial North Korea. You know, this horrible place you go where there's a dictator that knows everything and thinks everything and controls all your thoughts, that doesn't sound like a heavenly place when you think about it, which is why I do explore some of those ideas in Heavens on Earth. I mean, what are we talking about? You know, when after I die and I go to heaven, let's say I'm a Christian, I once was a Christian, so I'm thinking maybe I'm still in there if it's true. You know, and there I am with Jesus in heaven. So what's up there? Is it my physical body? And some Christians say, yeah. And I say, okay, how old am I? Well, you're 30. 30? Yeah, 30, because that was the age that Jesus was crucified. Okay. Yeah, but I'm 63 now. So what happened to the 33 years of memories that I've had? You know, I've lived a long life, and you know, doesn't that go with it? Yeah, that goes with it. Okay, yeah, but the memories I have now are different than the memories I had, say, a decade ago of being a youthful person. You know, the memories themselves change. There's no fixed you. And okay, no, it's just your soul. Okay, it's my. Oh, and then I quote from Julia Sweeney's funny monologue, "Letting Go of God," about, you know, like the blind shall see and the deaf shall hear and the crippled shall be made whole again. You know, this idea of a perfect heaven where everything's perfect. But as she says, well, I had uterine cancer, so I had my uterus taken out. Do I have to get my uterus back? Because I don't want it back. Or she says, you know, what if you had a nose job and you liked it? You know, do I have to get my old nose back in heaven? I mean, what are we talking about here when you're talking about resurrecting the body or the soul? And, you know, it's the whole thing is just fraught with problems. And, you know, Hitch was particularly good at identifying those. And I kind of pushed that even as far as I could in the book without being insulting and degrading of religion. Religion does a lot of good things. But, you know, I just don't think they have thought it through carefully enough on this whole idea of an afterlife and religion.
Yeah, I imagine that as you were pitching together some of your research and, you know, you pitch up what is heaven and where is it. But you have to be, I suppose, quite sensitive to, you know, people of different religious backgrounds who feel very strongly in all of these. I know that you talk about the geography problem and you write, if reincarnation is real, it means that souls in search of new bodies are migrating primarily in and around the Indian subcontinent. This alone should be a red flag for any discerning observer. And then you argue there is no Indian physics that differs from British physics. Now, I laughed my head off at that, but at the same time, another reader could find that particularly insensitive.
Well, yeah, I know, but, you know, I'm trying to be honest. You know, I'm not being snarky or sarcastic just for the hell of it. I mean, I want to explore these ideas as seriously as possible. And religious leaders have had a head start on secular thinkers in history. But now I think scientists are having something to say about these big questions, you know, the big moral dilemmas of life that I explored in the moral arc, and now the afterlife and immortality. What does this mean? And really, I only go after religion in just one chapter. My primary targets are the scientific attempts to achieve immortality, and I'm even more critical of them. Yeah. You know, cryonics, you know, the idea of freezing people and bringing them back, you know, 1,000 years from now or whatever, not going to happen. Yeah. It's impossible at the moment. The way no one frozen to date, there's a couple hundred that have been frozen. Most of them are in Arizona. Where it's pretty hot during this summer, you know, this damage to the neurons is too extensive, so your memories are gone. And, you know, this idea of uploading the mind, you know, first of all, we don't have the computing power to store even one connectome, the analog to the genome. That is, the connectome is all your memories, all the synaptic connections in your brain. We don't have enough computing power in the entire world to store even one brain. So, yeah, but they say, yeah, but, you know, Moore's Law, doubling power of computers every 12 to 18 months, you know, in a few decades, you know, we'll be able to store people's connectome. Yeah, but it's just at best, if this could ever be done, it would just be a copy of you. It's not you. Say, for example, we scanned your brain, your connectome, while you're alive in a sophisticated fMRI brain scanner, and then uploaded your mind into the cloud and turned it on. You would not suddenly leap into the cloud or inside the computer. You'd still be standing there inside your own head going, hey, I'm right here. That's not me. That's just a copy of me. You know, no more than a twin looks at its sibling and says, well, there I am. No, these are two autonomous persons, no matter how identical they are. You know, so even the scientific attempts to achieve immortality are just fraught with both practical and philosophical problems.
You describe Frank Tipler as a techno-optimist, and, you know, you say that he believes in humanity's cosmic destiny, and, you know, and he talks about Omega Point and all of that. But I suppose if science isn't being creative, adventurous, courageous and ambitious, it has nothing. And in order to push and strive for a change, you have to ask the question first of all, and you have to be optimistic, and you have to hope that you will eventually get there someday.
Well, I think so, but instead of aiming for utopia, I think we should aim for protopia. So protopia is a neologism coined by the futurist Kevin Kelly. Kevin is the founder of Wired magazine, and he's good friends with Stuart Brand, who created the Whole Earth Catalog. And there's a whole group of these kind of techno-optimists in Silicon Valley, and I like them because even though I'm skeptical of a lot of their sort of far-reaching claims about the future, I do like science and technology. I do think it's our best hope for leading a better life. But by better life, I mean, you know, just making tomorrow slightly better than today, and today slightly better than yesterday. Just progress incrementally, as Kevin says, just protopia. Aiming for utopia. The problem with aiming for utopia is, first of all, there's no such place. That's what the word means, utopia, no place. But it leads to really negative things. Like, if you have this vision of a perfect life, and there's these recalcitrant dissenters who don't agree with you, and, you know, they're standing in the way of eternal happiness for everybody. But for them standing in our way, we have to eliminate them. And this is really the calculus that leads to genocide. And we have to get rid of these people. Look, they're standing in our way of utopia. Okay, so aiming for utopia is a bad idea. But I do like the idea of using the best science and technology we have to make, you know, the world just slightly better tomorrow than it is today. And that really is what we've been doing for centuries.
Michael, you present some powerful research and some humbling, I have to say, research on final sentiments of death row inmates. And it was extraordinary reading them, and it made for engrossing and it was captivating reading, I have to say. But I did feel a bit kind of funny in another way, and that, you know, I felt I was creeping in on somebody's life to a degree. But you cite that just over 82% of death row inmates use positive emotions before they die, and 68% of them use the word love. I thought that was beautiful. And it probably kind of reverses some of the stereotype that we have of whether people who are in death row for mass murderings and so on, that you wouldn't expect the word love to come out.
Totally surprised me. You know, I kind of stumbled into this data set. The Department of Justice of Texas, who has executed more prisoners than all other states combined in the last 30 years, they record all the final statements that the prisoners make, and most of them do, and then transcribe them, and they're on their webpage. You can look up the Department of Justice for Texas, and you can find their death row final statements. And so I did a whole analysis, content analysis, of every one of them. There's like 486 or something like that, and I had some graduate students also code them, and then we ran inter-rater reliability correlations between the coders to see if we were all, you know, reading the same thing in our minds, so that it's not too subjective. And that's how we came up with those percentages. And, you know, it startled me. I thought these guys would be bitter and angry, and, you know, although a few were, most of them were, you know, kind of outpourings of affection, positive emotions, love. Interestingly, you know, lots of love for mothers, sisters, wives, their buddies in prison with them, and so on. Only one or two, I think, said anything about their fathers. And then I started, you know, researching a little bit on criminology, and noted that one of the predictors of violent crime is being raised in a fatherless home, or in foster homes or orphanages. And so I suspect a lot of these guys just didn't even have fathers. And, you know, that's a tragedy in itself. But in any case, you know, I was testing the terror management theory, which says that people are terrorized about death. And, you know, that never struck, I've known about this theory for a long time, never struck me as true, because I'm not terrorized about death, and I don't know anybody that is. And so anecdotally, it didn't feel right. And their reply to that is, well, it's unconscious. You don't know that you're terrorized about death. Okay. You know, already we're off in some Freudian Neverland there, where, you know, things are happening underneath the consciousness. That's true, but how do you know? And you have to trick the brain into releasing what's in there, and then it becomes problematic what's really being measured. So that's why I ended up doing that data set.
You also highlight that 14.8% of death row inmates pleaded innocence to the very end, which is incredibly disturbing.
Oh, yes. Well, I wanted to mention that in that section, because my previous book, The Moral Arc, I talk about the retributive justice versus restorative justice, and why the death penalty should be put on death row. It's really a bad idea. the very act that, you know, kills people, the fact that so many of them are innocent, and now we know for sure because of DNA testing, you know, the Innocence Project has found several hundred of these death row inmates were there mistakenly. They would have been murdered by the state, killed by the state. So, that's a problem. It is. We know that in addition to innocent mistakes that law enforcement makes and the criminal justice system makes, you know, it's definitely rigged against people that don't have money and minorities, particularly who are poor. You know, you really, in America anyway, you know, having expensive lawyers really can tilt the justice system in your favor, and that just that's not right. That's not what the Enlightenment ideal was of having, you know, equal justice for everybody. And, you know, so I throw that in there because, you know, that's a serious problem. We America here, you know, we're kind of the last of the bastions of the Western world to have the capital punishment. And even that, really, it's 31 of the 50 states still allow it. And of the 31 states, really only four ever do it with any regularity: Texas, Ohio, Florida, and I think it's Arkansas. You know, so it's close. I think we'll get rid of the death penalty by 2025 to 2030 at the latest.
What do you make of near-death experiences? Like, how do you understand it all? Do you see it them as some kind of a hallucination of sorts? I know you bring up Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, and he offered readers 100 case studies into near-death experiences. But it's, you know, some people really believe in this stuff.
Oh, they do, absolutely. And I'm not denying the experience that people have. These experiences are real. The question is, do they happen, are they real in the head only, or are they real out there in the world? So, you know, people say, well, we know that there's an afterlife. I've been there. Okay, what do you mean you've been there? Well, in my head, you know, I had this incredible experience while I was under anesthesia, or I was, you know, near drowning, heart attack, you know, stress or trauma, car accident, you know, these various scenarios in which people have this floating out of the body, going through the tunnel, the white light at the end of the tunnel, and the other side of the white light is their loved ones or Jesus or Muhammad or whatever. Okay, what are we to make of these things? There is now a lot of research on this from both a believer's and a skeptic's perspective, but just from a scientific perspective. For sure that this happens to a small percentage of people, under certain very narrow window of conditions that it happens under, you know, some kind of trauma, stress, oxygen deprivation, this sort of thing. And we can replicate the same symptoms or characteristics of the near-death experience in the lab. You can do it by stimulating parts of the brain during open brain surgery. You can do it through oxygen deprivation in an accelerating pilots in a centrifuge, for example. They have these out-of-body experiences. It happens when people are alone, like sleep-deprived or high-altitude. Solo sailors and climbers tend to sense that, you know, there's some presence nearby, and that they have these weird, you know, floating, flying experiences, and so on. So I summarize all of that and conclude that the experiences are real, but no one's actually going to heaven. There's no evidence. First of all, the descriptions of heaven are always different. So they're very personalized heavens, which you would expect if it's only in your head. If heaven was an actual place that you go to, it should be the same for everybody. So whatever it is, it isn't anything like a place. If there is a heaven, it would just be whatever is in your head.
You had your own woohoo-type experience with your wife some years ago, and you wrote an article subsequently afterwards and got a huge reaction. Can you tell me about it?
Yeah, I included this in the book because I want to acknowledge that these anomalous psychological experiences that people have are real in their heads. And how far beyond that we go, and, you know, it's very personal, but I've had my own. I've written about some of the weird things I've had happen over the years, like being abducted by aliens from sleep deprivation and other weird stuff under extreme conditions. But this particular one wasn't like that. It was my wife, Jennifer, is from Cologne, Germany, and she we fell in love. We decided we're going to be together. So she's going to move to America. And so she started shipping her belongings to L.A., where I lived. And you know, she had this radio that belonged to her grandfather. She was raised by a single mom and her father. So her grandfather, and she used to listen to this little Philips transistor radio from the 70s when they did stuff together, and you know, it was always kind of, he's gone now, and so it's sort of a memento that really was she cherished, but it was dead, didn't work, hadn't worked in years, and so you know, when she sent it here, I tried to fix it, you know, with new batteries and wiring and stuff like that, and I couldn't get it going, so just threw it in the drawer and left it there, and then the day of our wedding, which was kind of spontaneous and at my home in Southern California, you know, she felt bad a little bit. Nobody there from her side, no family, no friends, nobody. And she was feeling kind of blue, and so we, you know, just went to the back of the house to have a moment of quiet, and there we heard music playing. And, you know, after searching for, you know, the stereo system or my iPhone or my laptop or something that could have been playing this music, no, it turned out to be this radio, perfectly tuned to a station, playing this beautiful classical love, you know, sort of love music, romantic music, and, you know, played the rest of the day and night. We showed it to all the people that were there. It was like, wow, that is weird. And it played the rest of the day and night and then went quiet the next day. It's been dead ever since, and that's it. I can't get it going again. And, you know, so what do you make of that? Okay, so first of all, I wrote about it in Scientific American, where I'm a columnist, and, you know, I got a ton of mail, mostly from people that said, yeah, I had something like that happen to me, and they'd write me these long stories. And I have to say, you know, if they're reporting them correctly, like mine, it's like, okay, that's weird. You know, it kind of feels intuitively like there's something else out there. Now, you know, for a skeptic to say that sounds pretty weird. But the fact is, you know, we can't explain everything, and you don't have to explain everything. And if it's emotionally salient and personally important to you, then it's okay to appreciate the mystery and the experience without having to explain everything. That's fine. And we don't have to construct the whole worldview of the afterlife and the paranormal and the supernatural, God, all that. You don't have to go down that road. You can just say, look, where things happen, we don't know everything, and just leave it at that.
But is it not natural just to be, you know, whether it's inquisitive, curious in the world, to question things, and, you know, that the mind will always try and find a tidy little reason to fill in the gaps somewhere within what the mind doesn't understand? And
yes,
that it's,
that's right,
it's,
yeah,
it's easy to see how that one would presume something other than ourselves and something otherly is happening there, isn't it? Because that kind of sort of makes sense.
Oh, totally, yes. I mean, our intuitions are that that we live in a dualistic world. There's body and soul, brain and mind, corporeal and incorporeal, and there's matter and information. It just seems like that's the case. And, you know, and I can't prove that there isn't, for sure, but, you know, science is pretty materialistic in nature in that, you know, there's just stuff. But, you know, if it turns out there's more things, than in your philosophy, in heavens and earth, than in your philosophy, then that's okay.
Yeah.
I'm all right with that. I mean, if when I close my eyes the last time here on earth, I wake up and, you know, and I'm in this other place where Christopher Hitchens is and Carl Sagan and Stephen Jay Gould, my friends, and my parents, and, you know, that's okay. I'm all right with that. I'm not against it. Yeah. I'll be pleasantly surprised. And so we'll see. I'm not eager to run that experiment just yet.
But some of these great beliefs make the world less lonely. You know, you could argue that it makes people feel very comfortable in the world. It makes them feel a bit more protective. It's a cozier way to look at things than possibly a brute cold reality of dust to dust and random atoms and all of that stuff.
Yeah, so the question is, I guess, when you're facing death or you're with somebody who is facing death, what do you say? What do you think? And you know, I don't have the answer to that. No one does. You know, it's a personal thing to a certain extent. But for me, you know, we have to live honestly as we can. And I think the most we can say is, I don't know. We don't know. Nobody knows what happens after you die. If we knew for sure, we wouldn't have these great debates. I wouldn't have to write a book like this. And the fact is that all religions have different versions of what happens. They have different theories, and they don't converge upon one another towards some, you know, consensus about what's probably there. And that alone tells us it's very subjective, personal, context-dependent, dependent on the time and place that you happen to live, which century you live in, and so on. That tells us it's, you know, it's probably not real in that sense. But I think the focus is on having led a good life here. That's the only thing that really counts.
And that was what jumped off the page when I read your book, that, you know, before we get totally carried away with all the debt stuff, we should look at maybe, you know, what makes for a meaningful life, you know, a purposeful life, and, you know, how are we living today? And then from there begin all our questions.
Exactly, exactly, yes. The, you know, what counts is the here and now, not the hereafter. You know, this life, not the afterlife. That we really need to stay focused on that. Don't obsess about, you know, death. And I think most people don't. In any case, you know, people don't go to church so that, you know, they can be assured that, you know, that when they die, they're going to go to heaven. No, I think people go to church for all sorts of other reasons, having to do with social, moral issues, things like that. And the music, and the, you know, the sentiments, and hanging out with your friends, and so on. I think this idea that people are obsessed with death is not correct.
Thank you.
Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with American writer, journalist and the publisher of Skeptic.com, Dr. Michael Shermer, whose latest book, Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality and Utopia, has just been published by Little Brown. I asked Michael about his research trip to the Chopra Center in Carlsbad, California, and what he makes of the writings and ideas of Deepak Chopra. As Michael describes Deepak as a mind monist and himself as a matter monist, I put it to Michael, what's that when it goes out to play?
Yeah, so most people are dualists, that they think there's body and soul, brain and mind. And I'm a monist. I think there's just brain. I think the mind is just a word we use to describe what the brain does. So, you know, brain activity produces something we call mind, but it's just still the brain. Okay, so Deepak, he's not a dualist in the sense that there's two stuff, consciousness and the brain and consciousness, or brain and mind. He thinks there's just consciousness, there's just mind, and that all the material world is just an instantiation of consciousness. Now, this is a very Buddhist idea, and it's hard for us Westerners to get our minds around what these words mean in a Buddhist worldview. So that chapter I call the Eastern Wisdom Traditions, because it's not just Buddhism, you know, Taoism and Hinduism and others. And so I really delved into Deepak's worldview there by getting into his world, by going to his center in Carlsbad, California, and, you know, doing the whole thing, the meditation and the yoga and so forth. And, you know, it's really, I can see the appeal to it, not just the psychological appeal, but I think there's evidence that it changes your body. It physically makes you healthier to, you know, live this less stressed life, you know, drink tea, do yoga, meditate, you know, get massages, walk on the beach barefoot. You know, these sorts of things that, you know, Deepak talks about, I think they do make a difference. You know, lowering blood pressure, lowering stress hormones, you know, try to attenuate the thought flooding you have about, you know, what I would have said to my boss last week, I should have said, you know, forget it. It's past. You can't change that. It's a waste of time and energy to obsess about those things. I think he's right about those kinds of things. And Westerners can gain a lot of value from some of the practices, even if you don't believe, and I don't, you know, that consciousness is pervasive throughout the universe and that sort of thing. Yeah. I think that goes too far beyond the science, but nevertheless, I can see the appeal and the effectiveness of that worldview.
But when you talk about cosmic consciousness, all of that sounds so lovely and so and simple in another way that you can see the appeal, can't you?
Totally. Of course. Because intuitively, as I said, we're kind of natural-born dualists. I talk about in the book Paul Bloom's research at Yale and his developmental lab with children, where they do these with little preschoolers. These are a little puppet show with a mouse and an alligator, and the alligator munches the mouse, and the mouse is dead, and then you ask the little kids, you know, where's the mouse? Oh, the mouse is at this other place, and he misses his mommy, and he's scared, and he's hungry. You know, they at a very early age imagine the mouse somehow continues beyond the physical body of the mouse. The mouseness, it has an essence of mouseness to it. You know, what we would call the soul, but you know, kids don't have words like that. So they just describe that somehow it's continuing on. Again, this gets back to my earlier point we were talking that we can't imagine being dead. It's impossible. You have to be alive to imagine anything, right? So it's almost like saying, imagine there's no universe. I mean, nothing, no people, no planets, no stars, no galaxies, no light. And so people picture like a big empty space, but there's no space. There's no space or time. You know, there's just nothing. You can't, at some point, you can't imagine it. You stop and you just go, whoa. And, you know, that's the problem.
But if we look at the popularity of psychic mediums, you know, people will always want to you know, touch death in a way and speak to the dead and be in relationship with the dead. That's part of how we are as people.
Well, we tend to think when we've lost somebody that they're still, that they've gone someplace and somehow we might be able to connect with them. So I've written in other books, you know, that this is really dangerous nonsense. It's, you know, it's a scam. You know, we're talking to the dead. Okay, first of all, anybody can talk to the dead. You can sit there at your mother's grave and talk to it, but it's getting the dead to talk back that's the hard part. And, you know, this is what these psychic mediums claim they can do, you know, in a hotel room somewhere, you know, at, at $100 a pop. Okay, this is a scam. You know, no one's hearing from people on the other side. Again, if we knew, you could test this somehow, yeah. And we have tried to test it, and they always fail the test, so no such thing.
Michael, you bring up some terrific books in Heavens on Earth, and I must compliment you on your research. It's just made for such interesting reading. You do bring up Alan Segal's book, Life After Death, and it's subtitled A History of the Afterlife in Western Religion. And he argues, imagining a heaven involves projecting our own hopes on heaven and then spending our lives trying to live up to them. I thought that was put really well, and he's got a point, hasn't he?
Yeah, there's quite a body of literature on this that I find interesting to read, and yeah, so you know, three cheers for books. I as many books as you can read on a subject. You know, the literature search is important, and to see what other people have said about it, and then you know, you just sort of your assessment of that, and you know, we all kind of do that. We build on each other, and you know, the literature. Well, first of all, I'll acknowledge the sort of poetic literature about death and existential meaning. So on is really quite moving, and you know, the great religions of the world have contributed to that for sure, but not just them. You know, secularists, anyone who thinks about it has some deep thoughts about these questions. So you know, yeah, dive into it for sure. Yeah.
You have some beautiful passages also in the book on the grieving behaviour of animals, and you cite Cynthia Moss's iconic book, Elephant Memories. But you pitch up an extraordinary question, and you ask, does this grieving behaviour in animals correspond to mortality awareness? And it's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, so we don't know who is the first to realise that we're mortal. And we know animals grieve, and we have ancient graves, probably Neanderthal sites and early Homo sapiens, that looks like they intentionally buried their dead, which would be one thing because, you know, the bodies are rotting, you got to get them under the ground. But with grave goods, flowers and tools and things like that, which would imply that, you know, they have some notion of an afterlife and that the loved one is continuing on somewhere else, and they're going to need these tools. That I find fascinating, and of course, you know, we're animals, so what about other animals? And we know that elephants grieve, and primates grieve, and, you know, no, that doesn't mean they necessarily believe in an afterlife, but certainly they miss those they love and that are close to, and that's a very human-like idea. So I find that pretty compelling. And I'm after that in that chapter because I'm, you know, I got curious about, well, who's the first person to ever realize they're going to die? And by the way, when do children realize that? You know, sort of a great, like with in the animal kingdom, it's a gradation. You know, as kids get older, they start to realize more and more, you know, what this all means.
So where do we go from here, Tammy and Michael? Like, you've spent a career of over 30 years probing at all these unusual scenarios and big questions in life and life outside of life, if you will. So I'm just wondering, what questions, based on your research, should we be asking ourselves?
Well, I think the most important question is, what should I do to live a more fulfilling life? And in the last chapter, I deal with happiness research, how to lead a purposeful, meaningful life. And we know something about this now. There's been quite a bit of research in the last quarter century in what's called positive psychology. And, you know, having a purposeful work, a meaningful, purposeful work, a reason to get up in the morning, get out, do something productive, having family and friends and loved ones, people that care about you, people that you care about. You know, this leads to a more fulfilling life. Having some kind of spirituality. It doesn't have to be religion, but it can be. But, you know, it could be meditation, it could be dance, it could be art, music, literature, long walks on the beach, long hikes, you know, anything that kind of gets you out of your little space and into the bigger world, in a way that's contemplative. And then also non-egocentric activities, you know, volunteering, helping the poor, volunteering for nonprofits, you know, things like that, just doing stuff that's not just about you. Those are the kinds of things, you know, long-term planning. That is, say, you know, balance your daily life of just fun, pleasurable things with things that are not necessarily pleasurable but bring meaning. That is, are more long-term, like caretaking for a parent or a loved one. You know, that's not fun. I've done it twice for two of my four parents. I had step-parents. You know, it wasn't fun, wasn't pleasurable. It was, you know, tiring and uncomfortable and, you know, and so on, but I felt better about it myself for doing it. And, you know, those are the sorts of things we know. That, again, regardless of whether there's an afterlife or not, no one knows for sure, probably not, but if there is, okay, we can all be pleasantly surprised. But it doesn't matter, you know, because we don't live in the afterlife, we live in this life.
And for those who are just terrified and fear death so much, how would you console them? How would you go about putting their mind at ease?
Oh, focus on this life, on the people you know and love, on the activities you're doing. Don't obsess about the next life because, you know, we can't know till you get there anyway. And just try to talk yourself out of it.
And that was American writer, journalist and the publisher of Skeptic.com, Dr. Michael Shermer. Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality and Utopia is published by Little Brown and retails for just under €16 in paperback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Keith Thompson, who helped out with this evening's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to close tonight's broadcast with the concluding words of Dr. Michael Shermer from Heavens on Earth. Facing death and life with courage, awareness and honesty can bring out the best in us and focus our minds on what matters most, gratitude and love. Our sentience, yours, mine and everyone's, is ours alone and like no other anywhere in the cosmos. We are given this one chance to live, some 4 score trips around the sun, a brief but glorious moment in the cosmic drama unfolding on this provisional proscenium. Given all we know about the universe and the laws of nature, that is the most any of us can reasonably hope for. Fortunately, it is enough. It is the soul of life. It is heaven on earth. Thought-provoking words indeed. Good night.
Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.